Hey, pronouncers, welcome back. Exciting episode. Alex, our economist, our local industry economist, is back. He did an incredible talk at ThreadX, an incredible talk at Pronouncers, and we had to have him on the pod. Why? Because he's talking about our industry. He's talking about the data we need to be following and what we need to be thinking about and not thinking about as owners and running our business. So very excited for this episode. We dive deep into a bunch of things. Running the business as if you were to sell it, even if you never do. We talk about tariffs and we talk about a 2025 outlook. All right. But before we start, we've got five incredible sponsors that help us do this show every single week. The first one, BMAC Industries and DTF Superstore. BMAC Industries is a leader in innovative DTF printing. They have developed a really cool dryer and shaker. It's top-of-the-line equipment and technology as well. So you can check it out, bmacindustries.com. They just continue to push the boundaries of what's possible with garment decoration. And DTFSuperstore.com has been providing Campus Inc. with all of their DTF consumables. Very excited for them to be a partner in this podcast. Multicraft underscore daddy. Open up your Instagram account. You know the drill. Send him a DM if you haven't won yet. Send Dave at Multicraft your email address via DM. He picks out a winner every single week. They send PMI tape. They send all kinds of other stuff. That's really, really nice of them and appreciated. Multicraft screen printing and digital supplies have been around for over 50 years, providing the industry with top brands at competitive pricing. Plus, on your first order, mention the Printavo Pod. That gets you an extra 10% off your first order. Easy Way. If you've been spending hours cleaning dirty screens, that's a thing of the past with Easy Way screen printing and screen cleaning chemicals. Their innovative formulas are designed to work quickly and effectively, so you can spend less time cleaning and more time creating. Plus, they are all about empowering printers at all skill levels. They offer helpful resources and expert advice to help succeed in printing. Very, very cool of them. And yeah, they've got a ton of resources actually, easyway.com. DGIapparel.com. DGI Apparel, it's a really cool website made by MIT software engineers with a background in printing. DGI connects all of your distributor accounts, Sanmar, Alpha Broder, S&S, and so on, a bunch more. And they help you compare pricing, inventory, and shipping times across all of the suppliers on one site. It makes it really, really easy to use. But the best part is it's free. It's free to use because they have a different revenue model than usual. So that's really, really cool. Could just save you a ton of time on purchasing, so you could check them out, dgiapparel.com. Last but not least, GraphX Source. If you need a solution to help improve and reduce costs in your art department, GraphX Source offers outsourcing options for your shop that they've been doing for over 40 years. So they've been really helping shops be able to handle things like back office admin, creative art, mockups, steps, digitizing, and customer service. They plug and play with your Printavo account. They know all the statuses and everything to set up, and they could just start running right away. Hit them up, graphxsource.com. Mention Printavo Pod 24. That gets you 50% off your first vector, SAP, or digitized order. And we appreciate all of our partners for helping put on this show every single week. Let's jump in to the episode. All right. We've got an incredible episode. Alex Chausovsky, out of the Bundy Group, but you do an incredible amount of, should I say, economic advisory? Is that the right word? That sounds very fancy.
Yeah, it's not just economic, Bruce. So any decisions that business leaders need to make, whether it's economics or labor market or geopolitics, I mean, anything that affects, whether it's capital investment planning or inventory management, their people side of the business, I aim to help them make the best quality decisions using a data-driven approach.
Got it. So I think we need to give a little bit of background on Alex. I have now had the privilege of seeing Alex speak twice, once at ThreadX this past year at Print Hustlers. Bruce was not at ThreadX. But Alex, let me tell you, while you gave your first talk at ThreadX, I took a picture of every slide and sent a picture to Bruce saying, like, you messed up. You should have been here. This is incredible. This is the coolest talk I've ever seen. I think I understand the economy now.
Good. That's the whole intent.
Stephen the economist.
working as intended. That's awesome.
And so, Alex, give us a little bit of your just, you know, for those that weren't at Print Hustlers or ThreadX, can you give us a real quick background on yourself, what you do, and then we can kind of start diving into it a little bit?
Yeah. So, you know, my career started basically kind of in the market intelligence world. So I was tasked with identifying areas of the market that are potentially lucrative, studying those areas, writing reports on that, and then selling that research. And so it got me in the practice of understanding what really drives businesses, where the opportunities lie, and how companies can take advantage of that, you know, both from a product perspective and a vertical market perspective, meaning, you know, different industries and growth drivers and major trends, both technological and product oriented. Then I went to work for an economic consulting firm called ITR Economics. I spent about 6 years there. That is actually how I ended up in New Hampshire. I used to live in Austin, Texas, went to University of Texas for my undergrad, got married there. My kids were born in Austin. And then this firm said, look, we have seen you speak. We like the way that you deliver information. We can teach you the economic component. That's the easy stuff. It's being able to be up on stage, communicating these complex ideas in a way that people can digest and actually act upon. That's where we really want to see you thrive. And so I moved the family to New Hampshire, spent 6 years there. As you can imagine, COVID kind of threw a wrench in the works with all of the events and public speaking stuff shut down basically for 18 to 24 months. So we parted ways. I ended up building a consulting practice for a recruiting firm out of Chicago, which gave me a really good insight into the labor market dynamics, and most importantly, how talent strategy has evolved in the post-pandemic world, meaning what are people looking for? How do companies attract, hire, and retain talent? And then my latest venture, I work now with a company called Bundy Group, which is a boutique investment bank out of Charlotte, North Carolina. I work remotely, but it's looking at the world of M&A because, you know, both the demographic changes, meaning, you know, the retirement of the baby boomers and the really big time rise of private equity as an acquisition force has changed the game and led to consolidation in so many different sectors. And so I see that as the next big area of opportunity to help people. And as you can see, it's like a storyline. It basically has evolved over time. And now I am able to talk about all of those things, which is really helpful to business leaders.
You're gonna get Bruce hot and bothered right now. You said all the buzz. He's gotta go towel off.
Hold on.
You said every recruiting acquisition. Wow.
Bruce,
where do you want to
so,
dig in here?
Well, I had, just like you, Stephen, had all the pictures. I had all the written notes because I really like reading the data. I really like getting to what I feel like is the truth, which is, people can tell different stories of information, but like, no. Here's the core information and here's the trends and here's where I think things have been. Here's where I think things are going because of the information. You started off the talk. You literally said, I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like, look, and this was right before the election. So it was like perfect timing. It was, there's so much information coming from all sides and you know, their goal as media organizations is to really drive clicks, right? You know, more emotional drive, more ability to pull you in, to get you fired up. But I want to help you challenge misinformation. I want to just help you build the skills to help you be able to understand what the truth is behind whatever's being said and to help find the data and the information and how does that apply to your business. That was the premise. And that was what I thought was so powerful because you even had a chart. It said, you know, most, I think it was 80 something percent of executives feel like I believe it was the economy is in a bad space and or we're going to hit some sort of near-term recession. Can you talk a little bit about that sentiment from business owners and like, is it that business owners feel that things are worse than they are, or are they being smart by predicting something that, you know, to be in a safer spot than to not get caught with their pants down? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think the core issue at the heart of the matter here is the difference between fact and opinion, right? We live in a world where most of the information that we're digesting is somebody's opinion about what's going on rather than the pure truth of, you know, here's what happened. The sentiment is here's what happened and here's what it means to you. So they interpret it on your behalf. And a lot of people live in these kind of bubbles of whether you're leaning left or leaning right, or you try to be in the middle, but you tend to kind of mute the stuff that doesn't align with your worldview. And you tend to hyper amplify the stuff that really does support the arguments that you've convinced yourself to believe. So
yeah, that's so true. That's actually why I deleted Twitter.
Because it
just like reinforced my like
deleted. And, but know, how many times have you downloaded it again since you deleted it? Bruce deletes and gets apps like 4 times a week. Bullshit.
3 days dry.
Congratulations. So that's Alex, awesome. You talked a little bit about sentiment. So you talked about like executives versus economists. CEOs are the most likely to think that there's a recession coming, where economists are the least likely. So, you know, probably from an education gap. Yeah. You also talked about sentiment on based on your party lines. You showed a graph or an infographic that said, you know, when Republicans are in Congress, Democrats believe that the economy is not doing well. When Democrats are in Congress or in control, you know, in control, Republicans don't believe. But the only time both agreed were during the Clinton administration.
That's the last time.
Why do you believe that is? Do you think like that has anything to do with the internet, or is that just?
I think that we tend to not only operate in bubbles, but we tend to think that you know, the way that we view the world is the right way. And so the chart you're referring to, which was kind of the CBS News poll asking people, do you think the economy is doing well or not? And then they track the responses by your party affiliation. Basically, Republicans think the economy is doing very well when there's Republicans in control of the White House, and Democrats think it's doing well when it's democratically controlled. And when it's not your party in control, you think that things are going to hell in a handbasket, right? Like, that's basically it. In fact, I have this really interesting chart. This is new information. I know you probably won't be able to see this on
we can pull it up.
But yeah, I'm sharing this chart. So can you see this?
Yeah. So if you're on YouTube, you could see it. If you're on audio,
yeah,
Alex, go to YouTube.
This is the University of Michigan. So this is a different data set. This is self-identified political party and the art. Economic Expectations Index. And look towards the far right there. What you can see is that as soon as President Trump won the election, like nothing on the ground changed. GDP didn't grow or collapse. Retail sales continued to be good. Industrial sector continued to face headwinds. But look at what happened in Republican sentiment, and it just like goes through the roof, and immediately what happened to the Democratic sentiment. So it's a very clear confirmation that this is still very much the way that we run things is we think that we know how it should be and our party reflects that. And if we're not in control, then things are obviously not going the right way. So I just thought that was a really interesting thing.
So after election day, you know, the economy has since like taken an interesting turn in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
When you looked in your glass ball, did you see this coming?
So the important thing to note is that the economy has not taken a turn.
Okay.
Expectations for the economy have taken a turn. Again, it's very much we're trained to think that opinion is fact and it's not. So the economy has been doing, generally speaking, very well. You know, we've been talking about these expectations of a soft landing for almost 3 years now. Well, I can tell you, soft landing was definitely achieved. We've got both a labor market that is slower than it was during the boom period of 21-22, but still healthy. People are finding jobs. People are working and getting paid. We've got inflation, which is obviously the increase in prices, back under control. The latest reading is we're about 2.5 on the consumer price index. So that's down from a high of 9% inflation back in 2021. So the Fed, through its mandate of both ensuring full employment and relatively stable low inflation, they've achieved that. That's been the case now for over a year. And so soft landing check. GDP at a record level, right? We continue to grow. And not only are we growing, but the last 5 or 6 quarters, we've been growing above the 2% average. So, you know, the macro economy has been doing quite well, but that's not reflected in opinions, right? People think that things are not going well. They talk about the fact that they're paying prices that are 25 or 30% higher than what they were paying pre-pandemic, even though, you know, that's now 4 or 5 years ago. And so it's a psychological issue because we tend to be much more affected by negative things and we hold on to that negativity much more so than we are affected by positive things. When good things happen, our thinking is, well, it should be good. Like that's expected. That's the baseline. But when bad things happen, especially relative to our expectations, we're devastated by it. And it takes us a while to let it go about how it went down.
Okay. I know we've got a couple more questions. I got one more question for you on this topic. Recently, after we've noticed a lot of the private sector coming into government, Elon Musk starting this new thing and all the stuff that they're going to be doing. What are your thoughts on that? Where like Silicon Valley is Silicon Valley is starting to play in government a little bit more, which definitely. Is new or newer. How do you think that's going to affect government?
Yeah, I mean, if I look at the big ticket kind of proposals from the Trump administration, which obviously now includes people like Elon and Vivek in high positions of power, and he's bringing in a lot of other cabinet members that are, you know, very business-minded folks and less, you know, kind of career politicians, there's a few key elements, right? So the first one, and I think probably the most impactful from an economic perspective as we look to the future, at least in the immediate near term, is how we handle the tariff situation, right? Because tariffs could be really bad for the economy. They could be marginally a headwind, or in certain key elements, they could help people, right? So like the spectrum is quite wide. Beyond that, we've got the issue of immigration. Do we deport millions of people like President Trump has been talking about doing? We've got the issue of tax cuts, right? That's a very pro-business, very kind of stimulative type of policy. And we've got issues that are just like deregulation. So getting out of the way of business in terms of laws and regulatory environment enforcement. And so these are all potentially quite disruptive as we look out. But the sentiment that you alluded to earlier is that people feel that if we run the government like we would run a corporation with a P&L and accountability and, you know, a focus on the bottom line instead of just grossly spending money for no end, then that seems in the business world's mindset as a better way of running things, which is why I think people are quite optimistic about what the new administration holds, at least when it comes to the business element.
Interesting.
And so how do you apply the tariffs to, like, because remember when tariffs were implemented before, when the first Trump administration of us, hopefully this isn't, people don't take this as like a political thing. This is just like, how does this affect my company? And I'm biased on the sides. Well,
and for those that don't know, like the printing industry, like our blank garments used to come from the Carolinas. And then in the 90s, something flipped. I don't know exactly what it was, but that's why everything went to Central and South America. And, you know, so like it does affect our industry just slightly. So Alex, it would be helpful to maybe, you know, as you look at the printing industry, a lot of our garments are coming from South America, Central America are being, you know, being assembled there. A lot are coming from China. How do you think that affects us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we've seen President Trump propose on the tariff side is obviously there is a focus on China because the amount of trade between the U.S. and China is just so massive. But we saw just yesterday evening, he announced that 25% increase on anything coming in from Canada and Mexico as well, right? And there will be other countries in play, you know, whether that's India or Southeast Asian countries like Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, where I know a lot of, you know, Philippines, where I know a lot of textile materials produced. But it's not just the garments themselves that could be inflationary, right? The equipment, right? A lot of which is manufactured in kind of the more industrialized nations, right? The steel, the machines themselves from Germany, from, you know, other places in Western Europe. So it's going to have a multifaceted impact. I would say at face value, if there are these tariffs, and, you know, keep in mind, President Trump being from a business background, I think think knows very well the value of a carrot and stick approach, right? And I think a lot of the things that he's saying right now, before he actually takes the position of power, is giving notice to our trading partners that we would like to see certain outcomes achieved. In the case of Mexico and Canada, the focus is on cross-border, immigration. So if they can help us address that issue and the flow of drugs and other illicit items across the borders, he's saying, unless we see improvement in those two areas, this is what I'm proposing that we do. So there's a lot of posturing there. And so to answer your question more directly, Stephen, yes, generally speaking, tariffs are inflationary, meaning that the companies that are bringing in the textile goods from overseas, they pay the tariff at the point of taking hold of the goods. And typically what happens is they pass that tariff on directly to their end consumers in the form of higher prices, right? Now, what happens several steps down the road is those consumers, because they're now going to have to pay higher prices, are going to ask their employers for more money. So they're going to say, oh, cost of living is going back up. I need more wages in order to afford things. So at the end of the day, the companies themselves will also bear some of the burden of inflationary pressure related to that. But again, I don't want to say that it's going to cause a recession, as some people are saying. I think we really need to see what policy actually looks like when it's put into law, and then we can do a much better job of ascertaining the economic impact of it. Until then, I think it's a lot of posturing. It's a lot of potential things that could happen. But, we need to see the actual law be passed into action. And what I think President Trump will want to do is, instead of going at it alone, he's going to want to try to build a consensus. He's got the GOP trifecta now. He's got the House and the Senate aligned with him. So he's going to want to get congressional backing for some of these trade issues that he's dealing with. And that means it could be, 6 months, maybe even upwards of 9 or 12 months before we start to see the bulk of the things that he's talking about come to fruition.
And the effect of them will happen several years down the road. I think that's something you pointed out, is like this stuff doesn't change overnight. You know, the impact of what he does in a year we'll start to see in 2, 3, 4 years down the road, which is
interesting. Yeah, I would say in some cases, that's true. But, his latest messaging last night was, on day one when I take office, so this is we're talking about January 2025, I'm going to implement a 25% across the board tariff on anything coming in from Mexico or Canada. Let's just use that as an example, right? So certain key product categories, cars is a really great example. We get a lot of cross-border traffic in terms of vehicles. So that will have an immediate impact on the price of cars. Like, you're going to feel that in early 2025 if that holds true. Now, looking back, his previous policy changes, the tax cuts, for example, that were passed during his first administration, that didn't really start to affect things until 2 or 3 years into his term. The same thing for the Democrats, though. President Biden's, the Investment Recovery Act, the other initiatives that he did on semiconductor production and other things, it was almost 2 years into his term before that became law and started to affect things. So that's why I alluded to this kind of consensus building a system of backers, because yes, a president can do certain things by himself through executive order, but it looks much better for him if he's got the party backing to do so. So he's not acting unilaterally. He can say, this is a mandate that is not only given to me by the people, but I also have, Senator and House of Representatives support on this initiative.
I remember asking M&R, who's a manufacturer of screen printing equipment, Alex, about tariffs before, because they import their steel, or they did then, from Canada.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they had to shift supply chains around, but they first ate the increase in cost for a bit and tried to, make it a little bit less, sudden. And then slowly they raised their prices, to adjust for the increased cost of the of the goods. But the other interesting chart, which was in the Wall Street Journal this morning, which was how companies slowly adjust their supply chain, which I'm not sure how much it applies here, but I just found it fascinating. For example, U.S. imports on kitchen cabinets shifted completely from China basically to Vietnam over like a 2 year period. It was crazy. Just almost 100% of it moved all the way over.
Yeah. So what that article doesn't say, but is the reality of the world of business, is it is the Chinese companies that are building those facilities in Vietnam. So I was just at a conference last week.
So skirting around.
I mean, business will find
money will flow wherever it goes.
That's right. That's right. These guys are not going to want to lose their livelihood overnight. They're going to invest. They're going to invest in facilities in whether it's Vietnam, Malaysia, Thailand, Cambodia, and they're going to skirt around the tariff, which is why we've seen the U.S. government actually try to put more emphasis on not just China, but other places where they think Chinese goods are coming from, including Mexico, right? Because the whole point that President Trump is making is that a lot of these companies from China are building facilities in Mexico to get around the tariffs that are placed on China directly. So the issue is not necessarily, you know, where does the product originate, but rather who is the backer of that? Who is taking advantage of it? Who is benefiting from the economies of scale that exist, right? A lot of times event that I was just at. So they're bringing in flooring materials for residential and non-residential construction. And even though the lumber that they're importing says made in Cambodia, the original point of that lumber was actually China. So they ship it from China to Cambodia and then from Cambodia here. And this happens all the time, by the way. This is not a unique thing. Like I said, business is smart. They will find a way. As long as there's a profit to be made, they'll get around the tariffs if they can. So tariffs are challenging because it's an enforcement issue. It's a complex supply chain issue, as you alluded to. And companies have been working in this direction to diversify and get away from the places where tariffs are going to be most severe for many, many years. So this is not a new thing. But to your point, some choose to deal with it differently than others. Some will absorb some of that price increase before eventually passing it on. Some will immediately, they just call it pass-through pricing. They will immediately, you know, increase prices by 10, 20 or whatever percent to reflect what they're paying at the border to import the goods. So it's a very complex issue. But at the end of the day, the key element that people really need to understand is that ends up being a tax paid by the end customer. One way or another, you can't get away from that.
Wow. It's so interesting because I spent some time with Gildan. The cotton comes from the United States, turned into yarn, spun into fabric, shipped down to Honduras, dyed, cut, sewn there, then shipped back to the US for distribution. Just like crazy to see how quickly that happens. And they have offices in Barbados for some reason. Okay, Alex, you talked a little bit about, the rise of baby boomer businesses that are going to, either there's some writing on the wall for baby boomer businesses. And in our industry, a lot of small businesses are owned by that generation. And you said in one of your slides, operate your company as if you will sell it. Can you talk a little bit more and elaborate on this?
Yeah. So this alludes to the point of what does the market find valuable about a business? And in the investment banking world, especially when we're talking to a boomer owner looking to exit the company and realize the achievement of his life's work in terms of highest multiple paid and highest total payout, we talk about the four legs of the stool. So the first one, and I think probably the most important one, is stability. You don't want to see revenue that's really bouncing up and down. There are some sectors that are just naturally like that. Automotive is a good example, oil and gas production. So you have boom and bust periods. Buyers don't like that. And so the multiple will be suppressed to reflect the unpredictable nature of the industry in which you operate. The second element is profitability, right? You've got to focus on the fact that your job as a business owner is not to drive revenue growth. It's to drive profit, because at the end of the day, profit is what's going to be reinvested back into the business and allow you to scale and, do all the things that you want to do. So consistent track history of profitability and hopefully increasing profitability over time. The third element is scale. So we talk about, especially if you're looking to exit, as many boomers are, don't even think about that until you're kind of like in the 1.5 to 3 million EBITDA level, because that's when you're going from, a 1-5x multiple to now a 5-10x multiple. And if you're bigger, then you're likely to maybe even see a double digit multiple, right? Especially if that aligns with both stability and consistent profit growth. And then the last element, and this is really the point that, you know, a lot of times during the process, you get first the IOI, that's the intent to be bidding on a company. Then you get the LOI, the letter of intent. That's when you're actually putting in a written offer. But where we see the biggest deviation once the LOI is in place is when they start looking at the books and they realize, oh, there's not a lot of diversification to this business. So all of their eggs are in one basket. We're selling to one particular vertical market or one type of customer base. And business buyers don't like that. They like to have a well-diversified business, even if it means, you know, as a textile company or a printing company, you have different marketplaces that you sell to. I worked with one of the companies that saw me speak at ThreadX, and, you know, they've got a portion of their sales going through events and conventions and other things. They've got a portion that they sell into normal retail storefronts. They've got another line of business that's targeting summer camps and things of that nature. So that is some diversification, right? You might have one that's down, but hopefully the others will be up to counteract that weakness. And so you want diversification of customers. You want diversification, to our earlier comment, of supply chain, right? You don't want to be dependent on one country, especially if that country is vulnerable to tariffs. And you want diversification of your management team as well. You want a lot of different perspectives. You want people that are encouraged to challenge the status quo and to, you know, they don't want a bunch of yes men. So these are the things that you're looking for. It's stability, profitability, growth, right? And then scale. And then, of course, the diversity. So if you've got those four elements, you're going to get a really nice payday if you want to sell your business.
I think most of the shops are probably 500K to maybe 1.5 million-ish. Do you think these principles still apply as well? Or are there others that can help? You know, because I think, like, how do you help remove just the value being the equipment, right? Which unfortunately turns out to be some, like, you spend so much time in the business, but how do you get more value, right? Increase the multiple. And maybe some of that is the squeezing out more profitability. Are there, out of those four, stability, profitability, scale, and diversification, are there certain of those that pertain more to a smaller company?
Yeah, I think that when I think about some of the intangibles that we're really looking for on the buy side, you want something called like ARR, like recurring revenue, right? So that doesn't necessarily mean that you have a subscription-based model, which is obviously the ideal world where you've got automated subscriptions renewing, and so you can count on that revenue being there for you in the future. But like a recurring revenue is, for example, I use this this case of the company who's selling into summer camps, right? Well, these summer camps are going to happen every summer, right? And we can account on a new wave of campers coming in and wanting to buy a bunch of gear for the summer camp, or the summer camp buying it on their behalf. That's very nice. And especially for smaller revenue firms, like the ones that you mentioned, that's an important component.
Is if we can customer retention,
not only customer retention, but a retention of customers that are likely to repeat over time, to where you're not constantly having to fight for new customers, right? That's the stability element, is you can count on that business year after year after year. That's a big
component. So a lot of the shops listening to this are smaller businesses, under $2 million in top line, maybe $100,000, $200,000 of profit. If they're hearing this, they're like, I'm doomed. How do I exit, or how do I get out of this? You know, I don't know if I'm going to get EBITDA to $1 million. Like, that's a lot of work. What advice do you have for them? Do you recommend they try to, you know, like, merge with a bigger company and take a share in that? Like, what do you have for them?
So just because you're a smaller business, that does not by any means suggest that you're doomed, right? What it does mean is that you're not likely to get as high of a multiple as a bigger business would. But that doesn't mean that nobody's going to be interested in buying you. And in fact, private equity is really shifted the focus. So there are two concepts. There's the platform acquisition and there's the bolt-on acquisition. And private equity has been really good at finding bolt-on companies, which are smaller firms. They're accretive to the revenue of the other portcos or the portfolio companies that they already own. And they really fill a gap in their product portfolio somehow. So there's a lot of value in that type of acquisition as well. So I don't want people on the smaller side to be discouraged, because the likelihood that you, if you run a sound business based on the principles that I outlined, but just don't have the scale, there will still be buyers for you. You just have to be reasonable about the kind of valuation multiple that you'll likely receive.
And for other shops, like other industries, you could think about like Anheuser-Busch buys microbreweries, right?
A company really like
a company like Staples will buy mom and pop paper supply companies and roll them up into them and use their infrastructure. So like there are, you know, this happens in other industries. Can we talk about like owner involvement when you look at a business and you're thinking about acquiring it or advising? How much do you look at what the owner attributes to the company, their involvement in the company, things like that?
So I think the main factor that I would be looking for is, does the owner constitute a significant part of the revenue growth or for the company? Like, are they the main salesperson, or is the owner more on the ops side, right? Because I can bring in an expert to run the business much more easily than I can bring in a salesperson that would have those same relationships that the owner has after probably, you know, many, many years of building those relationships and be able to both retain existing clients and find new clients. So it really depends on what function in the business the owner plays. And a lot of the kind of ways that buyers deal with this is through the earnout clauses, right? So if the owner does in fact constitute, let's say I have all of the key relationships in my business, and that reflects about 60% of our total revenue. So if I were to just up and leave the company, that's big question mark in terms of the future owners. Like, can we retain that revenue, or are they going to look somewhere else? Which is why they typically require somewhere between a 3 and 5 year earnout period. So the money going to the seller will be, you get a piece of it up front, but then the rest of it is determined on how we perform over the next 3 to 5 years and on your ability to transition those relationships to other people that can be more sustainable even once you're out of the business.
Steven, do you think there's elements of running a shop that are different when you start considering trying to operate it as if you would sell it one day? I mean, I think there's like tactical, like, yeah, sure, you know, bring in the right people and stuff. But, you know, maybe you've talked about having really clean books, you know, bringing on a bookkeeper earlier, right? And just something very clean, easy to understand right out of the get-go. You kind of went through this transition, right, of buying into more of a family-owned business, then fundraising. Like, it's a bit of two different trajectories.
I mean, when I bought into Campus Inc., and I'm on year 10 now, for the first 6 or 7 years, is a family lifestyle company, right? Like, bootstrapped, we own the entire thing. You know, we hire a local bookkeeper. I'm super involved in it. You know, wanting to create good profit, a good healthy lifestyle, make good money, you know, have the business serve me and my family and my business partner's family. The second we fundraised and we raised money from institutional investors, the dynamic shifted, because the only way that they will ever make money is if the company sells for a much higher multiple than they invested in it for. So immediately this, like, I put on a different set of glasses and said, okay, do we have a CFO that can manage our books properly, right? Are we looking at our percentages every single day? What's my involvement in the business? And that was one of the big things, was like, I cannot touch every part of the business and control it and it depend on me, right? Because, you know, the business needs to support itself. So Bruce, to your point, it almost was a forced hand where, like, hey, now you're playing, you went from the minor leagues to the major leagues. You have to look at this thing completely different. You are the largest shareholder. You're just one part of the machine now. And that was a huge mental shift for me, almost like immediately within the year. right?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with everything that you said, particularly those two elements of the difference between a lifestyle-driven business where, you know, they care to a point, but if it's making enough money to keep them very comfortable and they've got their summer place and they've got their boat on the lake, they're not really concerned about driving growth or, you know, diversification of customer or supply chain. I mean, I see this all the time in the lower middle market cap, which is where we tend to operate, is these companies are run just well enough to sustain, you know, $1 million in annual income for the owner. And beyond that, they don't care. They're not actively out there trying to grow the business. The second part that hugely resonates with me that tends to be the downfall of many of these smaller businesses is not keeping good books, man. I mean, it is so, so important for somebody else to be able to come in and very quickly be able to tell if you're running a good, efficient business or not. We have actually had to completely redo the books for many of the clients that we've served, and that has delayed their ability to go to market by years. You know, so we typically start our conversations, we say 2 to 3 years before we're ready to go to market with companies to make sure that everything is lined up and all the ducks are in a row so that the market perceives them. Oh, okay, this is a serious business. This is not just lifestyle. We can get a good sense of their performance through their books, and then the process can go in, you know, 6 months. Otherwise, it's just like,
Bruce, why did you laugh? Why did you laugh there when Alex talked about a lake house and a boat? I'm so confused.
You're like, I mean, Steven definitely has gone through the lake house and boat process, which I feel like a lot of, you know, which is good. I mean, I feel like things are working, you know, business is profitable.
The best day is when you buy a boat and sell a boat. So I'll talk to you next spring. Anyways,
Steven, with you consulting shops, how do you help them get clean books if they don't? I'm sure you've chatted with shops that you're just like, dude, you guys, I can't fully help until I can see the data here. What is the step? Is it QuickBooks and a bookkeeper? Is it, you know?
Yeah. So the first thing that I look at the P&L right off the bat, and I just want to ask lots of questions, and I just want to hear what they're going to say. And they're like, well, revenue isn't really accurate because, you know, we collected that money like 90 days later and it was a $40,000 check. So we can't really look at September. And, well, that profit, we didn't make any money because we bought a bunch of equipment, and then I did, you know, I depreciated this and that. And so a lot of times their books are telling a different story than how their business is actually running. And when you're using a local bookkeeper, that's what they're going to do after the fact. They're going to optimize it for taxes to make everything look clean, but they might not give you a good picture on a weekly, daily, monthly level of how healthy your company is. So actually the first thing we do is we actually try to build real-time trackers, and we try to understand what is your daily burn, what is your overhead every single day, how much does it cost to turn your lights on, and then we try to figure out, okay, how many orders do you need to sell a month to just have a healthy business? And so sometimes if the P&L doesn't look good and it's not clean, I'll advise them to go get a good bookkeeper, overpay for someone really good, but at the same time, we
believe
in like...
Is that local, or what do you recommend for that too, or overseas?
I mean, we've had, you know, like a couple CFOs, like fractional teams on here, like CFO or Orba or Sparks, someone that is going to take a enterprise look at your books, but still have common sense, right? We don't want to overdo it a little bit, but really what we start to do day one is we do real-time tracking. So like we're entering in and we're doing it all in Google Sheets. And I'm like, you know, if these all track and they look good, your bookkeeper will have no issues at the end of the month. And you'll be able to show them, hey, I broke even at day 20, right? And I know what my payroll is and my overhead. So we just try to extract major KPIs, and we just try to teach them how to get addicted to their numbers in a more, a more common sense way that they can do every day.
Yeah, those extractions, I think one of the key elements is to extract things that are not going to continue once the business is sold, right? The adjusted EBITDA view. So like if you have a bunch of family members on the payroll, right, that are not going to be there once you exit the business. You know, that's an important thing. I would say for the smaller shops in particular that try to get a sense of it, get a sell side Q of E done, a quality of earnings report. It's a small investment. I would
say. How do you do that?
There are lots of independent firms that do this, and you want it done by an independent third-party firm. Quality of earnings. Yeah, it's a really standard practice in the M&A world when you're going to sell. Before, it basically gives you a reasonable expectation of what your valuation is going to be from the buyer's perspective. Right. So they look at your business without ever intending to actually buy it. They look at it as if a buyer would, and they help you identify those shortcomings that you need to address, as Stephen was alluding to. So sell side QOV, really worth looking into. I think on average, it probably costs somewhere between like $7,000 and $15,000 to do one of those. So it's a bit of an investment, but you get a real sense of your company's value at the end of that process.
Financial clarity is one of the most beautiful things in a business. We have the privilege of now having a CFO, and he has his entire team. And he will tell me, you know, money's made in the percents, and they drive percents down. They tinker and they tool, and it becomes fun. And I don't know if every business can necessarily get to that tomorrow, but starting to think about financial clarity, it helps you sleep at night. Your quality of life goes up significantly more. So,
and just to reference, there's a couple links people said, sparkbusinessconsulting.com. That's great. They're profit first methodology to help you with bookkeeping. And then he talked about Orba, ORBA.com. It's fractional CFO, which we had in the pod as well. So that's like level one, and then maybe like a level two of different options.
Can we talk about price increases? Bruce, you asked a question. Yeah. I'll let you dig into this, Bruce. Go for it.
Yeah. My immediate thinking was, Alex said, you said something in the effect of, all right, look, one of the effects longer term now with this inflation is we're not going back to this old 2-3% inflation, you know, marks very soon. It's probably going to be more baked in around 3-4%. And that's something that we should expect and plan for and accept and move on. So my thinking was, you know, we're all really bad at adjusting pricing. You know, I think before you even like quote someone, it's like this weird internal conversation of I don't know, it's probably too high, and you cut yourself down before you even give a proposal. But I asked, hey, Alex, well, should we be making sure January 1st we review pricing and we really think about it? And at a minimum, whatever the inflation chart, you can Google it, we put that onto our pricing and we move it up. Your response was, if you're doing it annually, you're way behind. You got to be doing it more frequently and relooking at that more. Like, what do you mean by that? And what are the best practices for this?
Yeah. So I would say the thing that you have to remember when you're looking at pricing is it's not just necessarily an across the board conversation. You have to look at your pricing from a profitability perspective. You have to look at it at a customer level, and you have to look at it at a product line level, because the profit margin might differ greatly. In fact, most companies don't realize this, but they have a key subsegment of their customers that are very, very profitable for them, and that are very long tail of meh, and some that are outright costing them money to do business. So you can't just look at the overall perspective and say, I'm going to band-aid over some of the problematic customers by just instituting across the board price increase. But you've got to be doing that more frequently than once a year, especially as new elements come into play, specific material price increases, tariffs, for example, the cost of equipment is going to go up because of steel or aluminum price increases. So when you have a kind of a pivot, a change in the doing business as usual environment, you should ask yourself, what is the impact of this change to my profitability? And where am I likely going to feel that the most? And which of the customers do I need to have a conversation with? Because I'm likely costing myself a lot of left on the table dollars as a result of doing nothing. So I would say, 6 months is probably much, well, it's definitely much better than once a year. I have companies that are buying, you know, large scale companies that where we're talking about making a change could be the difference of millions of dollars of profit for them. And they have to be doing it much more frequently. I have ones that do it on a monthly basis. Now, they have a team dedicated to pricing analysis, profitability analysis. So the smaller and medium sized companies, I think I would say at least twice a year. If you feel like you're big enough and there's you see the benefit of doing that more frequently, then contemplate doing it, you know, three times a year, maybe even quarterly. But I would say get away from the notion of once a year, it's not good enough. And get away from the notion of, I'm just going to say to everybody, we're increasing your prices by 5%. You've got to look at it selectively and have specific.
That's interesting. And I think it's, you know, we see at SNS Activewear, Sanmar, Alpha Broder, you know, the prices, like our Gildan t-shirt, you know, used to be $1.60 when I went into business. It's two and change now, right? And that marginal difference, even though it's 10 or 15 cents, as you multiply that up, that should grow your top line, or you should make that adjustment and you're eating away at your profit. It's interesting. I grew up, my dad owned gas stations growing up. And so every single night we were calculating weighted average margin and figuring out what the price is going to be based on the amount of gas that was underground. And that's like that's an extreme thing, because that's how the gas station industry works. But we need to take a little page out of that and say, okay, we should look at this quarterly. We should look at our contribution margin. You know, we should look at it by customer base. It's definitely complicated, but it's something you really, really can't ignore.
Is that more tailored to, you think, contract? See, I mean, because if people are taking their matrix, right, doesn't it already pull in the cost of goods? Granted, it doesn't adjust for everything else, right? I mean, maybe if rent was adjusted, labor is adjusted, just consumables, purchasing, all the other stuff.
I'll give you an example. Like every year when we do raises, you know, there's different type of raises. You can get a Campus Inc. You can get an inflation raise. It's just we're just bumping you up for cost of living, or you could get a higher raise. And so like over time, our labor percentage is going up, right? And so we need to make that adjustment, right, everywhere else in the business. So I don't think it's just on the price of a t-shirt. I think it's everywhere in the company, right?
Yeah, there's an equation, right? Like if you think about it ideologically, there's an equation with all of the different inputs into what constitutes your cost of doing business, right? So it's a little bit of work to set up that equation initially, but then once it's existing, you can look at it at any point in time as a snapshot and say, oh, that piece of it has gone up substantially. What am I doing to account for that increase? Or am I just going to eat that on margin, right? So it becomes more of a tracking and an upkeep thing rather than a let's relook at pricing all of a sudden. And I think that that's the way that businesses need to approach this is. Yeah. Really understand the fundamental drivers of it.
And once you have a baseline, it's up to whoever's in charge of it. So like our CFO, yeah, his job is to get our books looking good, you know, figure out where's we can make more money. But he also goes back and renegotiates with vendors, with shipping, UPS and FedEx. He goes back with SNS and reviews pricing with them and says, hey, we bought this much more. We need a better deal on it. And so it's really also up to you to go and renegotiate.
Stephen, because in the shipping and logistics space in particular right now, the arbitrage opportunities for spot pricing in the trucking market are quite advantageous relative to contract pricing. So if you have a, let's say you have a FedEx contract that was negotiated 12 or 18 months ago, and you can go and shop on the spot market, you can realize substantial savings, really boosting your profitability on a customer or a line of customers. That's the kind of understanding that you get by doing this equation-based approach and tracking the different elements of the equation and understanding when there are changes happening and then acting on those changes.
Farag, you mentioned if labor costs increase, for example, for an annual raise, let's say, and maybe your baseline was, okay, this year labor was 25% of our costs. Now it's looking like 30%. What does that trigger in your mind? Because I think people can apply this as to any size of a business. Does that mean that the top line needs to grow so that labor comes back down to 25%?
Yeah. If I want to hold 25% and I said I want to, then that means I need to make up that margin somewhere else. So I either need to reduce my expenses, or I need to increase my revenue, or I need to sell more of something, right? And so you can, you know, sell more of the same thing. You can make more on what you're making, on what you're selling, or you can reduce the cost to actually run the business, right?
That makes sense. It's like a pie. It's like that one part just squeezed out the profit, basically. So you got to squeeze it back down.
Well, and the best in class companies do both, right? Because if you're able to both marginally bring down costs and marginally increase revenue, it's a less of an ask on both fronts rather than just focusing on one or the other, right? So I think the focus should be on what are all of the levers that I can pull in order to maintain profitability at where I need it to be. And what do I need to put in place so that I can pull all of these levers simultaneously as a ongoing process within the business? Who needs to take responsibility for this?
Alex, you talked about looking forward into 2025, and I know we have a little bit of time left. One of the things you talked about is focusing on employee retention. Can you elaborate on what you meant by that and the advice that you were giving to shops?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is that while the labor market has cooled dramatically, the positions that are most in demand, particularly the production line work, you know, anything that's hourly, blue collar type, we just do not have the people. And there's so much choice available to folks in terms of the types of jobs they can do. I recently saw a billboard, you know, you can make $25 an hour sitting on your couch in the living room and scheduling medical appointments for people, you know, virtual medical appointments. So like, how do you compete with that if you pay your production line folks who are expected to be there in person working 8-hour shifts, you know, $25 an hour? So it's this notion that not only is there a lot of choice out there, but there's just not enough people willing to do that type of work that says you have to make sure that the folks you have are happy. And that doesn't mean that they have to be ecstatic, but they're content, that they feel listened to and heard, and that you are doing everything you can to, you know, treat the employee as a partner. So what I mean by that is historically, especially before COVID, there's this kind of notion that I'm the boss, you're the employee, and I'm going to project power down. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. And that doesn't really work very well these days. Now the system is, we're partners in this. I will tell you as a business, what do I need from you as an employee to be performing to my goals and to growth targets? But I'm also willing to ask you and then listen and try to do what I can to give you what you need from me in order for you to be successful. So that partnership tends to be much stickier than the traditional power down projection dynamic. And that's what companies really need to focus on doing is, you know, you don't have to be the top paying company in the industry, but there are lots and lots of levers available to you in terms of, you know, giving people what it is that they want. One specific example that I've seen companies employ very, very effectively is a few additional days of off the books PTO. So I don't mean shifting to, you know, unlimited PTO. I don't mean changing the company policy. I mean, you empower your managers to say, give them a few extra days throughout the year, as long as they tell you in advance that they need that time off and you work out a system to where the job still gets done, but give them that flexibility. People appreciate flexibility so much these days that that's a great value perception to them. And it doesn't actually end up costing the business that much, if at all, because the work still gets done. So it's that type of relationship that will help organizations retain people. And they need to do that because, you know, the
that's
cost.
True. That is a great carrot.
It is. The cost of replacing someone and the loss of efficiency in getting that new person in and trained up is just so painful.
And I think there's a hard pill to swallow, you know, 10, 20 years ago, show up to work, do a good job, make a paycheck, don't complain, right? And now there's a little bit of entitlement and livelihood and the creator economy and hacker economy. And I can go drive for Uber, I can go do something else. You can't blame the workforce that they are adapting to changing times.
Correct.
They're trying to do the best they can.
The best example that data supports this notion is the amount of new business formations in the United States since the start of the pandemic. We're over 2x what we were on average in the 10-year period prior to COVID. So like over 400,000 new businesses formed in the United States every single year because people that whose employers are treating them the way that you just described are saying, screw it, I'm just going to go out and do something on my own. And they're finding success in doing so. So, you know, It's a really phenomenal thing. It's good for the economy. New businesses, especially ones that thrive and then go out to hire more people and continue growing, are a very, very important fabric of our economic performance. But it's a great example of how we know people are not standing for the BS of years past.
The last thing you mentioned that I think was pretty notable is cash is king, borrowing costs will remain high. There's a lot of financing that obviously happens because, you know, people need to expand, buy equipment, you know, bigger space, whatever it is. How do we apply this, right? Is it, you think, try to carry a bit bigger of a bank balance? Is it, you know, plan a little bit more for the seasonality and be less aggressive on growth? How do you think this? Yeah. What do you think a small business owner does?
I think the key element that I'm trying to stress here is that project ROI, whatever it is that you're looking to spend money on, whether it's a new piece of equipment or an expansion of the facility, whatever it is, you've got a higher threshold for the desirable level of return on investment of that project when you're paying 8 or 9% to borrow the money than when you were paying 5 or 6% to borrow the money, right? So if you can fund that increasingly through the cash flow of the business, that's going to mean better outcomes for you in terms of COGS, in terms of profitability, in terms of all of these things. So it's not always the case for all businesses, but particularly on the really small side, you know, these businesses oftentimes pay double digit rates to borrow money. And so you've got to be very judicious about how you deploy that borrowed capital. Whenever possible, use the cash flow of the business and the profits that we talked about before, right? That's why profits are so important, because they allow you to make investments at, you know, basically zero cost in terms of borrowing and carrying costs. So the more you can do that, the better off you're going to be. I think that what we've seen lately is the Fed recognizes that they're in restrictive policy rate right now. They're looking to come down. But depending on what happens with tariffs and some other inflationary elements that we've already covered, they might not be able to keep pushing rates down, or else inflation is going to surge again. So with the anticipation, as we discussed earlier, that, you know, you've got to prepare to operate in a higher inflation, higher borrowing costs environment, whenever you can use cash flow to fund all of your initiatives, you're going to be better off long term.
Cool. I want to wrap by talking a little bit about the Printavo data that you took. So Bruce open sources a lot of Printavo data, so you can see the trend lines in our industry, and we can put a link in there. Alex, you took a lot of data that you've created or that you look at, and you layered it on top of the Printavo open source data. Can you talk to a little bit about that, what you're seeing in the industry, how accurate it is, and what we can look for going forward in the printing industry?
Yeah. So the business cycle analysis that I did using Printavo data basically looks at kind of the vital signs of the businesses in this industry rather than the top line growth. So I am not tracking overall revenue. I'm tracking year over year and sometimes quarter over quarter growth. That's what I did. I used average store sales with the Printavo data set to kind of normalize the series to be representative of the industry as a whole. And then I correlated that on top of clothing retail sales data. And we saw that there's an almost identical alignment from a, you know, the timing of the low and the high and the turning points in the cycle between Printavo and retail sales at clothing stores. Now, that allowed me, once I established that relationship, it allowed me to use what is called leading indicators, which are predictive data series that where I can use historic data that's already happened to tell about the future of what retail environment data is going to look like. One great example of this was disposable personal income, right? So if disposable personal income is growing, people will have more available funds to spend on things like clothing in the future. And so that leads, and I don't remember the exact lead lag relationship, but I think it was around 9 months. So it basically shows where the momentum in the industry is going 9 months into the future. And this is not a forecast or a guess. This is based on historic performance of disposable personal income data. So what I was able to see, and, you know, between ThreadX, which happened in the spring of this year, and the fall conference, the Print Hustlers event in Cleveland, we saw that the data of Printavo behaved exactly as the disposable personal income suggested it would. It actually turned a corner on the low end and started heading upwards. So we now have verifiable proof that there is this relationship between the two series. And so companies can now look at that data, look at it the right way, and be able to say, okay, I feel pretty confident about the momentum of the industry being up and accelerating over the next 9 months rather than expecting further deterioration for the business. And that allows them to get out ahead of the planning thing, right? Like you're talking about how much inventory you hold. Do I invest in new production capacity? Do I, you know, hire more people? It allows you to connect that to the different operational functions of your business and then kind of come out earlier than everybody else in the industry that doesn't have the insight of that data.
And if you want to see this, you could see disposable personal income. Just search for it in Google and yeah, you could see the economic charts to be able to follow it. Alex, this is awesome. What email can we share? So if people do want to reach out to you.
Yeah, it's simple. alex@bundygroup.com, BUNDYGROUP.com. One other element that I highly recommend for businesses to check out, it's called the FRED database. It's put out by the St. Louis Federal Reserve. It pulls in so many different data series, including every one that I mentioned on the talk today. And it gives you a real good sense. They already have a built-in data visualization function as part of that website. It's absolutely free for you to use. And there's amazing types of data on there. So take advantage of that resource.
I'm going to link in the description as well, the clothing retail sales index and the disposable personal income index. So you guys can take a look and be able to track it for yourself.
Yeah.
Alex, this is always amazing. We'll have to figure out something as well to do. Maybe regularly we'll chat, but
yeah.
Print Hustlers, we appreciate you guys joining us this week for another episode of the podcast. We'll see you guys in next week, next episode.
Yeah, thanks for having Thank me, guys. You. Take care.
Thanks so much for listening. Hopefully that was informative. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to like. Don't forget to hit the bell for notifications if you enjoyed this video. If you enjoy all the stuff we're putting out, it's really helpful. We love to just be able to see it. That means that we're doing a good job. To subscribe, hit the bell for notifications and hit the like button. And I'll see you in the next episode. Bye.